Crystal Tower Information Whiskey, 2153 Zulu, wind 0605.
0606 Mike Juliet, this is Archer Radar contact.
SOS weather information from Minnesota available on flight service frequency.
You've dialed in the Flying Midwest podcast, connecting aviators from across America's heartland. Sharing news, information, and events from around the region.
Calling Nifty 53 on Nogatai, Roger. Turn left heading 070, runway 9R, clear for takeoff.
Sit back, relax, and join our crew for some hangar talk as we discuss a wide variety of regional aviation topics.
Archer 711435, runway 280 left, clear takeoff, left.
And now, from our home at the Anoka County Blaine Airport. Our checklist is complete, and we're ready for departure for another episode of the Flying Midwest Podcast.
Contact departure on your flight.
Well, everyone, welcome to another edition of the Flying Midwest Podcast. We have another episode that comes with a little bit of unfortunate circumstance attached to it. As heard in our last episode, we paid tribute to Richard McSpadden by replaying his episode after he had passed in a aircraft incident in New York. So we originally planned within our scope of when we wanted to publish which episodes when. The episode with Lauren Jones is our next episode that we were ready to prepare for production and go through the editing process, things like that. And as I began the process of getting the audio files ready to ship off for editing, I had learned of the news of Lauren's passing in an aircraft incident in southern Minnesota. This one hits a heck of a lot closer to home. Maddie, I know that you've got a lot of time with Lauren and a lot of interaction, and he had quite an impact on you. So we want to continue with this episode and play the interview that we did with Lauren at AirVenture, but we want to do it in the spirit of memorializing him and his passion for aviation.
I've known Lauren a long time. Lauren actually did my Discovery flight back in 2018, so he was my first real exposure to small aircraft, and it was really, really fun. I still remember that flight to this day. I had no idea what was going on, but I was having fun. We did my first and only ever touchdown on a grass strip on that flight. I still have not done that since. Although I did not know anything about aviation, is that his passion for aviation was phenomenal. He, like, infectious even. Lauren loved aviation and every aspect of aviation. That really showed in his career, and it showed in all the things that he loved to do. So over the years, he owned many aircraft. He was an airline pilot for a while. He was also a lawyer, which is, he always joked about that. But he loved all aspects of aviation. He was the chief pilot at my flight school for a long time. And in his retirement, he decided to start building gyroplanes, which you will hear about in this episode. He was very, very passionate about them. They're a funky, underrated aircraft, and he wanted the world to know about them for sure, as they have declined in popularity over the years. One thing about Lauren is he loved what he did. And you could tell, and you'll be able to tell in the interview of the passion that he had.
So clearly you had a lot of interaction with Lauren over your aviation journey. What kind of impact has Lauren had on your aviation career?
I think when I think of really having fun in aviation, he's who I think of. Like, if I had to embody fun in aviation, he would be that person. Again, he loved what he did. Like, every second, every time I flew with him, it was another adventure. He would figure out how to play music over the GPS. He would do, he'd, you know, occasionally do some wacky, wild things. Like, I was flying and I was, you know, grousing about, oh, I don't know how to fly by the seat of my pants. He turns everything off, so I have to. Or saying, oh, I don't know what an incipient spin is like, so he tossed me in one immediately. So it was, it was always something new with Lauren. But, you know, I learned a lot from him as far as the details and just the sheer breadth of aviation. I flew with him over the course of a lot of ratings. So he started me back my first couple hours in the airplane. And then I didn't see him again until I was getting my instrument. And at that point, it had actually been a year since I had started flying. So on that day, we ended up flying together. And so he took me to lunch at in Brainerd, Minnesota. So we had a tater tot casserole in some little diner on the field in
Brainerd. Is that Wings Cafe up in Brainerd?
I have no idea. I don't remember. It was a while
ago.
It
is a great destination.
I just remember I almost ran into two cat planes, and he's like, don't do that. Well, I didn't know. I didn't know where they were going. They were taxiing so fast. Anyway, he always had something new. I think that was the fun part about Lauren, is he always had something new that he was interested in and excited about. He had been flying for many, many years. And even still, even though he was retired from the airlines and everything, he still found things that excited him. And that was something that I was really big on, was I wanted a career that I would constantly find new things and find excitement. And Lauren embodied that. I figured if he can still find enjoyment in everything and not be a bitter old airline pilot, then I can too. He was doing what he loved, and that showed in every second of his existence. And it was really quite something. It was quite a sight to behold.
So now that you're instructing, what influences from him will you take and pass on to your students moving ahead?
The joy. What I do, you know, as this career, especially being a CFI, is hard. It's taxing. It's stressful. And it's scary sometimes. But past all that, the things that I have to kind of stuff down a little bit, because that's my problem and not my students, is the joy of it all. You know, in rigorous flight training, that can really be lost. And I saw that during my private pilot training. It was very rigorous and I had no enjoyment because it was just hard. But Lauren showed me that it doesn't have to be hard. You know, when you know your airplane and you know what you're doing, you can just kind of be a little bit free with it. And you can show just how fun aviation is to your students. And I think that is often lacking. Also flying by the seat of your pants, that was really helpful. And I have definitely shown my students that. And that has been very helpful in my career. But I think the most prominent thing is definitely the joy.
I think I caught a glimpse of that from you when we were at AirVenture before we went to go do this interview. After you had connected with Lauren and we figured out some timing to get this interview done, just how excited you were to try to make sure that we got there and got this all taken care of and got a good interview with them. And just, I think for me personally, watching you do big chunks of that interview was fun for me too, just to see you two bantering back and forth. And and I had just met Lauren that day, but I mean, you're right. His passion right out the get-go was infectious. And him and the guys over there by the ultralights were great for us. We were able to hang out for a bit, check out the gyroplanes, learn a lot more about those than I ever even thought of. I think the fixed wing stuff that you fly in GA typically, and the ultralights don't always come to mind, but I was really intrigued after sitting down and talking with him. So,
yeah, the first time I heard about gyroplanes were shockingly from Lauren. We were supposed to be doing MEI training, but he decided that he needed to take the half an hour to show me about the new thing that he found, and that was gyroplanes. And he was very excited about it. He was going to go do speedy course with this dude down in Iowa who actually was in my Facebook group and would post stuff about helicopters and gyroplanes all the time, which was cool. That was an interesting little connection. But you could tell he was just so psyched about this thing that he found. He wanted to do it. He would do anything to make that happen. And he did. When he'll hear about this in the interview. But while we were at Oshkosh, we actually got to see Lauren's pride and joy, his gyrotechnic little yellow gyroplane. I actually got to see him fly it, which was pretty cool. And he actually won an award for it. He won the Silver Lindy Award for the gyrocopter category. So he was very excited to send me that after we had done our interview. It was quite the moment.
And I think the ironic thing of that, we had so much conversation during the interview about gyroplane, gyrocopter, what's the difference? And EAA has it listed as a gyrocopter class. So
It is very funny.
Well, we've done an awful lot of talking about it. I think it's time to share our interview with Lauren Jones from AirVenture 2023.
Well, welcome, Lauren, to the Flying Midwest podcast. Thanks for coming on with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Have you been on a podcast before?
I think this is my first podcast.
Oh, wow. Yeah. First time for everything. Yeah.
You know, I was saving myself for the right show, you know.
Well, welcome to the party.
Yeah. So, Lauren, can you give us a little background about yourself?
You want to do the Fast Five first? Or?
Yes. Just kidding. Stand by on that.
All right.
So, to start each episode, we typically like to have what we call our Fast Five questions, where we ask five rapid-fire-ish questions, and I say rapid-fire-ish because you can expand as much as you want.
Okay.
And then it's just to kind of get us warmed up and get everyone comfortable. And
doesn't require one more dance.
Nope.
All right.
All right. So question number one, what is your favorite aviation event?
Oh, clearly Oshkosh is at the top of the list, but I had an awful lot of fun at Wauchula. It's been some days. Wauchula, Florida, this last February went down, or April, March, I guess it was, which is the first time there, and that's all rotorcraft, you know, gyroplanes, but Oshkosh, there's nothing like AirVenture, you know, it's the be-all and end-all of air shows and pilot gatherings.
I'm sure that the next question, because of the topic we're going to talk about, I know what the answer is going to be, but I'm asking anyways. Favorite aircraft to fly?
I might surprise you in that I love virtually every aircraft. There's no aircraft I haven't enjoyed flying. You know, there's some I have enjoyed less than others. But currently, by far, my favorite current aircraft is my new gyroplane. It's just so much fun, and I'm having, you know, such a ball with it that right now it is definitely. But I've had many favorites along the way. A Super Cub off of grass on a spring day is, I always said, was as close to heaven as you can get on Earth, you know. Well, now I get rid of all of the, I don't need the window open or anything because I'm just out there smelling the fresh grass and stuff in my open frame aeroplane. So it's, it took it just a hair above the Cub in that regard. So
next question, since we are at AirVenture, favorite location on the AirVenture grounds?
Ironically, I've been coming to AirVenture since 1978, not every year, but at least every other or third year, I try to make sure I get here. And so a lot of times it was a day flying. In all of the years I've been coming to AirVenture, I never made it down to the ultralight area. And so this is my first year there. And now I'm thrilled to spend my days here. I do sneak up to see the vendors and stuff, but there's so much going on down in the ultralight area that I've really been enjoying hanging down here and meeting other rotorcraft people and other sport aviation kinds of things that I don't normally spend a lot of time around. So that's been really fun.
Two more to go. This question, your favorite part of AirVenture?
You know, historically, it's been, you know, probably the air shows. That's what everyone comes for a lot of times. Now, I've seen the air show so many times that now it's just time with other aviators. You know, that really is the best part of the AirVenture.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the people, you know, is the best. It's always great, you know, like there are vendors. I chose some avionics for my gyro that haven't been used before much here. I've flown with them in an Italian-made gyro that I trained in, and I was really impressed with them. So I decided I wanted those in my gyro. Well, they're out of Slovenia, all right? So we've worked with them remotely, but they were just delightful to work with and so helpful and customized stuff and things for us. And other gyro pilots that have seen them, I go, yeah, this is great. So getting to meet, you know, one of the guys from Slovenia is here for AirVenture. So being able to meet with him one-on-one and you know, ask questions and things that, you know, it's just that personal connection, you know. So I enjoy going through the vendor booth areas and seeing kind of the new goo-gahs and, you know, look for the latest toys.
All right, last question. If you could meet anyone in aviation, dead or alive, and have a conversation with them, who would it be?
Thanks to Air Venture, I have gotten, you know, meet some of the greats. Chuck Yeager comes to mind. I got to meet him at Air Venture, not like we were one-on-one. It was a small group. Mike Patey is one of my current heroes. I got to meet him here last year and chat with him a little bit. Just, you know, such a phenomenal designer and stuff. Looking back, Neil Armstrong probably would have been, and I've seen Neil Armstrong, but I've never had a, so I think, you know, first man to walk on the moon, that would, you know, and all of those guys were great aviators. And I guess I'd also have to throw Charles Lindbergh, you know, being, I was born in Minnesota, and he was raised in Minnesota, you know, so another Minnesota great, you know, I think that would have been a, you know, if there was probably one, he might be the one I would pick. Of course, go back, Orville and Wilbur, they had to be a hoot to hang out with. So we'll see.
Very nice.
Well, great. Thanks for answering our Fast Five questions. And we'll dive into the actual interview portion of things now.
Skip the meat and potatoes.
I say meat and potatoes way too often, so I'm trying to find different words.
Nuts and bolts.
The nuts and bolts of the episode.
There you go.
Take it away, Maddie.
All right. So, Lauren, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes. I was captivated by aviation as a little kid. I remember when I was, believe it or not, 3 years old, we had a Northwest airline captain come and speak to a vacation Bible school class that had an aviation theme, believe it or not, way back in, it's many decades ago, but that sparked an interest, and then grew up watching Sky King on TV, and I always knew I was going to learn to fly it the first chance I could get, and wanted to be an airline pilot when I was a little kid. And then I got glasses in third grade. Back in the day, you know, airline pilots didn't wear glasses, you know, it was 2020 uncorrected to be an Air Force pilot. So that was fine. I didn't deter me, but I switched careers and decided ultimately to be a lawyer. But I learned to fly at the first chance I had in college, and was fortunate to have access to a really nice airplane a friend had just bought and made available to me. So I flew a lot my last 2 years of college. Went off to law school thinking I wouldn't fly again for 3 years. And after a month of law school, I was just climbing the walls because I hadn't been up in the sky in more than a month. So one beautiful September day, I wandered out to the airport to see what I could rent, and got checked out in Little Warrior, and the instructor said, you know, you really should be a instrument rated pilot. Yeah, I said, yeah, what's involved in that? We talked about it. I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll come tomorrow, we'll do an instrument lesson. So after class that next day, I went out to the airport, did an instrument lesson. That was kind of fun. So that kind of became my routine. I'd go to law school till 3 o'clock, go out to the airport, do a flight lesson, get home about 6, make dinner, study till 10 or 11, get up and do it all over the next day. So during my first year of law school, I did my instrument, commercial, multi-engine, and my CFI. And then they offered me a job teaching for them as an instructor. So I taught the rest of law school and loved to teach, and have been teaching ever since. That was 43 years ago. After law school, I just used airplanes in my general aviation. Didn't do a lot of instructing for some years there. And then one day somebody asked me, well, you know, can you teach instruments? And I said, well, I could probably add my double I. So I went and added that. Later, someone wanted to do a multi-engine. So I added my MEI. And so I've been teaching part-time while pursuing my other careers. And in recent years, I've come back to just teaching full time. I'm still a licensed lawyer. I still do a little bit of law, but most of my time I dedicate to aviation. I teach now for Endeavor Airlines, which trains with CAE in Eagan, Minnesota. And so I'm a full-time sim instructor with them, but it gives me a lot of time to teach others in general aviation, and has given me an opportunity to fulfill my dream of building my own aircraft and being able to fly it to Oshkosh.
So I think, speaking of teaching, you have a connection to our friend Maddie here. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, Maddie was a student at the flight school at which I was the chief flight instructor for a number of years and had the privilege of flying with her as a private pilot and part of her instrument and part of her commercial. And, I mean, all the way along. I don't know if we flew together for your CFI. You did that down south, right?
I did my first flight with you.
Okay.
Pretty cool. And 96 went to Whiskey. Okay. And then we did a couple flights, and then I moved down to Florida. We did my private down there. Came back for instrument.
Okay, that's right.
Did both commercials down in Florida, and then I came for CFI, double IMEI with you guys.
Awesome. Yeah. I've flown with Maddie quite a few times. So yeah, we've had fun training. And I still teach one to Whiskey occasionally.
Oh really? And
the new owner of it asked me to help him finish his private.
Oh,
so.
No kidding.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got 1,500 hours in that one airframe.
Wow.
So
that's crazy.
It might be the most hours I have. I think the Mooney I had for 12 years, I think I only ended up with just shy of 1,500 in. So I might actually have more hours in 1-2 Whiskey than the plane I actually own for the longest time. I expect to exceed both in my gyro soon.
Oh, yes. So, speaking of gyros, so you've been on a little bit of a journey since you have, I don't know what you've been doing, but yeah, all of a sudden I saw a post on Facebook of you doing something kind of special with gyrocopters. So, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I was sitting at a little airport in South Dakota one day, and here come the jets by. Yep. Once the jets start.
Yeah, look.
So anyways, I was waiting for a student doing a multi-engine check ride, and a guy pulled up in a little gyroplane, and I asked him if he minded if I looked at his gyro, and he said, "Would you like to go for a ride?" And I said, "Yeah." And he took me for a ride, and I was just smitten. It just looked like so much fun. So we talked about it. Turns out he was a surgeon, and when COVID shut down all of the surgery, he said, "I was bored out of my mind. I always wanted to learn to fly, and gyros looked like a good idea." We'll ride out the flybys.
I just like the big solid line.
And then he went down to Missouri and knocked out his sport pilot for gyroplane, and then he bought one, then he bought another one, then he bought a third one. So he currently has four, and now he's building one like mine. That was all the impetus I needed. So I called the same guy that trained him and said, "When can I come down?" And we set up a date, and I flew down and knocked out my sport pilot endorsement, and then was graciously allowed to fly his gyros to get some experience with them. And then in February of this year, my wife and I went down to Gulf Shores in Alabama for a week. And I had set up training for my commercial down there with a flight instructor and a DPE that operate down there. So I did a week of training there and got my commercial. Two weeks ago, I went to Searcy, Arkansas to fly with Ron Menzies, who's been flying gyros for almost 60 years and is just instructing in them forever. And he's a DPE. So I went down to train with him and with another instructor who then signed me off. And then I did my check ride with Ron. So now I'm officially a gyro CFI. So now I need a 2-seat gyro to go with my 1-seat gyro.
Well, congratulations. It's quite an accomplishment, especially within the matter of a couple days each ratings.
And then along the way, I ran into Gyrotechnic, which makes an amazing kit gyro. And they were only an hour away from me. And I was like, yeah, I want to do that. So I met them last fall and been in communication. And then in July, through a series of a kit that someone was going to start on, all of a sudden they couldn't complete it for health reasons. And I said, I'll just take it over because I'd already ordered the motor and stuff. And so I bought the motor from the guy, and they hadn't even started on the build of the airframe. So I was able to jump in, and they had headed painted. They had powder coated. So he picked the color, but I loved the color. As soon as I saw it, I said, yeah, I want that one. So I got to do the build. I did a factory assist build at their facility because they've got just wonderful expertise right there from the designer on down to his guy that's amazing with engines and systems. And then he's got an electrical guy that's a wizard for wiring panels. So, you know, they made me do all the work, but they were there as a resource and say, nah, there's a better way you could do this. And then they would, you know, and they helped me. I don't know if you've ever designed an electrical panel, but I've designed computer networks, and there's some corollaries there, and that actually helped. But I learned a ton, and that's the whole purpose of the experimental aviation, is for educational, you know, purposes. And boy, I got a whole, new education in systems and electrical and all of that, which was really extremely rewarding. And when the FAA came to inspect it, you know, for him to be able to walk through and say, okay, well, tell me about this. Okay, well, that's the ECU, that's the engine computer, and, the, you know, it's tied into these systems and monitor, and we talk to the instruments via the, you know, and you have the knowledge of your aircraft that normally you don't always get, you know, when you're just renting an airplane or even an airplane you own, you give it to a mechanic. So, and then I went through that same process a week later with another FAA inspector to get my repairman certificate. And he went through my build log, which is a very detailed photographic. And we photograph every step of the way. And then I put day by day, I'd take pictures of everything we did that day. And I built a nice online log via the EAA's website. So I just sent the link to the FAA guy with my application. I said, here's my application. Here's the link to log. And he called me the next day. He said, that's a great log. He said, I learned a lot just reading what you posted in there. So he asked a few questions, and then he issued me my repairman certificate. So I got my CFI on Wednesday, and I got my repairman certificate on Friday. So two FAA certificates in 2 days. I think that's a personal best for me.
Yeah, wow.
So how long did the build process take for you then?
Yeah, it was just about almost exactly 6 months to the day. And when I say 6 months, there were periods of maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks where I didn't do anything because we were waiting on parts or, you know,
sure,
avionics or things. So there were gaps in there that I didn't do anything. And then there were stretches where I'd go down every day for 3 or 4 days in a row and work all day long on it. All in all, I think I logged in my log around 240 work hours on it, which is, if you look, you know, most airplane kits are talking in the thousands of hours of build time. So to be able to build something in 240, 250 hours is, you know, great. And it speaks to the completeness of the kit and the quality of the documentation. And that also speaks to doing the builder assist program because they're right there. You do all the work, but they're there to answer a good, I don't know, how does this work? And usually if I couldn't figure out from the blueprints and the Dennis, the designer, next thing I knew, he was on his computer updating that blueprint and the instructions that went with it to make sure that the next dummy didn't get confused by that point. So he's a perfectionist, and he wants everything about his product to be to that standard. So it made the process so enjoyable. Plus, they became friends. You know, he and his staff. Every one of them was just so helpful at every, you know, different points along the way. Doing the radiator and cooling and stuff. Grant is his, you know, systems guy that just knows engines inside and out and could answer my questions and help me do stuff. And then Mike was the electronics wizard. So when it came to the panel, it's like, okay, Mike, here are the blueprints. How do we hook this up? And in the process, he taught me how to properly crimp and all of the other stuff. But I had to crimp every pin on every Molex connector that tied the engine into the rest of the aircraft. And even that, you know, oh, it's pin 7. Oops, I put that in pin 9 slot. Okay, now we got to get that out of there. So I joked with the FAA inspector that I met the 151% rule. By the time I put it together wrong, undo it, and then redid it correctly, I clearly was over 51%. So
we talked a little bit about your experience building it. What was probably the hardest thing about building your own aircraft?
Clearly wiring the panel. I mean, I thought I was 90% done when we got to the panel. And it's like, okay, now we just have to put the wiring in. And then as I started on it, started looking at all the schematics, and we laid out the wires on the, and there was a bundle of wires that's almost as thick as 3 fingers, you know, of wires. And we'd label each one. Now we have to figure out where they all go. Then I realized, okay, the 90% is to go, because I'm wiring this thing up. And I mean, when it was all put together and stuff, and we snaked that cable through, I mean, literally it was a bundle. We had to actually do, because I added some nice features in mine that we haven't, that a lot of builders have. Yeah, ADS-B, you know, well, now I got 2 antenna cables that have to come through, things like that. So that was probably the most challenging, putting the main airframe together. I mean, it's like an erector set, you know, you follow instructions, put the bolts together, and pretty soon I got good at remembering, oh, I got to put a washer on the bolt, and then another washer, and then I put, you know. So there were a few I slipped in and forgot the first washer, and then I'd have to undo it. So that was all pretty straightforward, but tying all of the systems together and integrating the avionics and programming them all up, that was the real education along the way.
So once you've got it all built, for someone who hasn't experienced flying one of these, what's it like to fly one?
For those who've flown motorcycles, it's like getting on a Kawasaki 900 that can fly 20 feet in the sky. I call it my sky cycle. It's a motorcycle in the sky. It's like you're just out there enjoying the fresh air, but you don't have the idiots on the road trying to kill you all the time. You're just out there with, you know, you smack a bug here and there, but that's about the most risk you got along the way. So they're just incredibly nimble. You think about where you want to go and you go there. When you come in to land, you can land and you touch down and you'll roll 2 or 3 feet on most days. Even the slightest wind, you can almost stop in 2 inches, you know. So just being able to touch down and, you know, you can literally put them anywhere. I'm convinced they're ultimately one of the safest aircraft with proper training. You know, like any other aircraft, there are gotchas along the way that are easily avoided if you're trained to avoid them. But without proper training, people have hurt themselves in gyros, but people have hurt themselves in airplanes as well.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. So training in any area of aviation is the key to being able to safely enjoy, you know, the wonderful sport that we have. So, yeah, it's just a thrill to fly. It climbs like a homesick angel. It can land on a dime. And along the way, it's as nimble as the most nimble motorcycle you've ever been on. So I was out flying the river the other day near the Mankato Airport where I've been doing my test flight off of. And in my test area lies the Minnesota River. In the summer, it gets down to a level that there are lots of sandbars. So you got a place to land all along the way. So I'm skimming along about 15, 20 feet over the sandbars and river, because there's nobody ever down by the river. And I look over and here's a bald eagle flying in formation with me. And I looked over at him. He looked over at me. And I could almost see him give me a thumbs up like, that's really cool. And that was just magical, you know. So I think I had my GoPro running at the time. I haven't gone through all of the footage. I'm hoping I captured that moment with the bald eagle flying in formation with me. So
that'd be fantastic.
It was magical.
So cool. Just real quick, because gyrocopters aren't very common, I feel like I've only seen a couple of them in the wild. For those who may listen and not know how what a gyrocopter is or how it works, could you just give us a quick rundown on that?
Yeah. The gyroplane is in the rotorcraft category. So its lift is provided by a rotor, just like a helicopter. The difference is what we call a fixed rotor. The majority of them are a fixed rotor, meaning the blades don't articulate like a helicopter blade. So they're much simpler. And but they do teeter, which helicopter blades also go up and down for the same reason. And but in a fixed pitch teetering rotor, they teeter so that they can balance the lift. The blade going forward at your 3 o'clock position is seeing more relative wind than the retreating blade at your 9 o'clock. And if you don't have a mechanism for compensating for that, that lift on the right and the blade on the left is going to stall and you're going to roll to the left. And that was the gotcha, even in the early days of trying to get any kind of rotorcraft flight. They were fine as long as they could generate lift standing still. As soon as they move forward, that advancing blade getting more lift and the retreating blade losing lift would cause them to roll onto their left side and crash. And then they discovered by teetering, that advancing blade can teeter up, which reduces its angle of attack and reduces its lift. And the retreating blade teeters down, which actually increases its angle of a lift, giving it more lift, and they balance each other out. Now, in straight and level flight, that teetering is about an eighth of an inch out on the end of a, 23-foot rotor. It's very small, but that's enough to compensate for what we call dissymmetry of lift. The difference between an advancing blade versus the relative wind the retreating blade sees. So the other thing that distinguishes a gyro from a helicopter is that in a helicopter, the rotor is spinning and drawing air down through the rotor and providing a downward force to create the lift. In a gyroplane, all of the air comes up through the rotor. So our motion is provided by either a pusher prop or some early ones had the tractor, propeller out front. Most of the current gyros have a pusher prop. So that gets you accelerating forward. And then you tilt the blade back to get the air going through it. And it's like a pinwheel. When you blow on a pinwheel, it's the airflow that causes it to spin, and that's what generates lift. Now, the key, and one of the other gotchas in a gyro, is you need to get that spinning a little bit before you start moving forward. Otherwise, the wind can't get it going. And we have what we call pre-rotators, where we can engage a pre-rotation mechanism that will spin them up to around 150, 160 or so rotor RPM before we start moving forward. And that's critical because if you don't have them spinning fast enough and you gun it and go fast, you're going to get that dissymmetry of lift and you're going to roll over. So as long as you're aware of that, now we pre-rotate to 160, 170. We disengage the pre-rotator, bring the stick aft, that tilts the pinwheel, if you will, into the wind, and then we slowly apply throttle and we let it accelerate. And as we accelerate, it spins faster and faster. At about 200 RPMs or so, we'll feel our nose lift off a little and we'll what we call balance on the mains. You're just riding on the mains, so you relax a little of that back pressure. And somewhere around 220 rotor RPMs, it becomes a wing and it just lifts you magically into the air and away you go. And like an airplane, you can lift off in ground effect. And some people, if you try to climb too steeply, that's the third gotcha, they'll get on the backside of the power curve. And then that rotor is just a big parachute. And you won't have enough power to power out of it. So as soon as you break ground, you just reduce that angle of attack a little bit, accelerate to its optimal, its best rate of climb speed. You know, it's about 50 knots. It's amazing how close a lot of gyros are. They're all in that 50 to 65 range. About 50 knots, mine just starts going up like an elevator. And then you're golden. And then my rotor stabilizes. It's usually in flight, 340 to 350 RPMs most of the time. And that's just kept by its forward motion. You're going through it. So it's kind of a unique aspect of rotary flight. But the beauty of it is you are always in auto rotation. So in a helicopter with that downward, the air is coming through the rotor. If you lose your engine, you have a fairly brief window of time to change your angle of the blades via the collective to transition to auto rotation to the air coming up through the rotor. And if you don't do that quick enough, you lose rotor speed and you might not be able to get it back before you need that rotor speed to flare and land. In a gyroplane, you're always in auto rotation. It's always in auto rotation. So if I'm flying along 15 feet in the air and my engine quits, I'm still producing lift.
Sure.
I just can't sustain level flight. I'll lower the nose a little bit, come down, flare, boom, I'm on the ground and stopped in a foot or two, and we're all done, you know. So, you know, the beauty of flying the gyro is you're looking now, I could land there, I could land there, I could land there. And the places that you can say I can land there are a lot more than my Cherokee 180. So that's the aspect that I think makes them safer once you're properly trained. In an engine out scenario, of course, we run Rotax engines, which just have a bulletproof history. So I'm never anticipating having an engine out, but a good pilot is always prepared for the unexpected. So you're always looking. And like I said, I can put this down in just about anywhere safely and with very little risk to anybody on the ground because it takes so little space to land.
So what kind of speed and range do you get with a gyrocopter?
Again, typically the limitation on speed is going to be governed by aerodynamics in that retreating blade stall.
Sure.
So you'll find most gyroplanes probably have a max speed of about 120 knots maybe. Because at that point, you're just driving, you know, you reach a point where you're going so fast, you know, the rotor can't.
Yeah.
It doesn't have the range of the teeter to handle. Now, in mine, it's capable of probably about 90 knots, but I don't have any airframe around me. I don't have a windshield. It's just the wind is hitting me in the face. So I can do 90 knots, but when I come back, I feel like I've been in an MMA fight, you know.
Yeah.
And been beaten about the head for the last 20 minutes. So I find in that 50 to 60 knot range is a great cruising. It's comfortable and I'm throttled way back. I'm at 4,800 RPMs on a 5,800 RPM, you know, motor. So I'm burning like 2.8, 2.9 gallons an hour and I have just under 10 gallons, so I've got almost a 3-hour range at my normal cruise at 50 to 60. So I can go about almost 180 to 200 miles and on a one tank of gas, and that tank is less than 10 gallons.
Wow.
So, you know.
Economical.
Very economical. It's the cheapest aviation fund I have found yet. And that's part of the reason I went with the engine choice I did. I went with this is the first 912 IS, the IS being the injected version. And the IS claims to be about 20% more fuel efficient than the carbureted. My friend Lee here built the first one with the regular 912 ULS, which is carbureted. And we've been flying together. And that seems to be borne out even for the kind of low-level flying we've been doing. I end up having about 20% less fuel burn than he does for having just accomplished the same flight. And I wanted that range. I wanted to know I had the gas. If I want to go to a breakfast fly-in,
sure,
you know, I can get there and I can get back, you know, without having to worry about finding fuel or whatever. So, and I met that goal.
Does it fly on avgas or mogas?
I burn mogas with the non-oxygenated, the non-ethanol. I find the pumps that have the premium unleaded with no alcohol. That's what I prefer to fly in it. I'm anxiously awaiting, you know, AMI 100 low lead. I bought the STC for my airplane, hoping to spur it along. But yeah, I mean, I think it's good that we ultimately do get the lead out.
Yeah.
I can burn leaded in it just fine. Some people live only on leaded gas. There are some additives you can put in a half on in a half ounce of Declan to a full tank of gas. Basically, it burns the lead out of it. So if in a pinch, I could certainly do 100 low lead, but if I can burn the unleaded, I try to. Here we're burning the Swift that they have available here.
Nice.
They've got Swift fuel, so that's cool. The 94 octane, I think, unleaded.
Sure. Okay.
So because, again, gyrocopters, there's just, you know, you're the only gyrocopter, is it gyroplane or gyrocopter? I can fly a gyrocopter.
Well, that's an interesting... at one point in time, gyroplanes kind of, I mean, they started with a Spaniard back in their early 20s, but they didn't really go anywhere. It evolved into the helicopter world, but Igor Benson kind of brought them back in the, I think, late 40s, early 50s with the Benson gyrocopter. And at that point, he claimed trade name or on the gyrocopter. So some people kind of steer away from it. The advantage of the gyrocopter term is that it at least affiliates some people with helicopter. So they're looking for something with a spinning blade as opposed to, you say, gyroplane. And it's like, what's that? Then they're thinking plane. There's got to be something with wings and a gyro in it. But so... when I'm at I'll just say yellow rotorcraft.
Okay.
That way, I'm kind of covering all bases, but some actually like the term gyrocopter because, again, it has that in there. But the real purist, and for the FAA's perspective, it's rotorcraft gyroplane and rotorcraft helicopter.
Okay.
So there is no gyrocopter in FAA parlance, but, you know, you'll hear it quite frequently among people. So yeah.
Okay.
And the early gyros, the first one that was developed was, they called it an auto gyro, G-I-R-O. And there's a German manufacturer that has co-opted that name. So auto gyro is a brand name for a German made gyro plane.
Now that I am educated. So
now we need a two-seater to take you for a ride.
Yes.
That's what we're going to do.
Yes. I
as soon as I have one, you'll be the first call.
Yay. So because, you know, you're the only gyroplane CFI that we're aware of anyway in Minnesota, and they seem to be a bit sparse. You know, they're not very well known. If somebody is interested in trying to get into this hobby or, you know, make it a career, what would you suggest to them?
There's a association called the Popular Rotorcraft Association, PRA. And honestly, off the top of my head, I can't remember. It's PRA.com or PRA.org. One of them will take you to the wrong place. But just search for PRA and gyroplane, and you'll get to the right place.
Okay.
And they've got a ton of resources on there, information about gyroplanes, and actually a list by state. I need to get them to update it since I'm the only one that will be listed in Minnesota. But they list the instructors around the country, and there are some, but we're much more rare than airplane CFIs by a very wide margin. So, but we think that's going to change over the next few years because they seem to be on a resurgence now because so many refinements have been made that make them safer, more dependable. You know, a lot of people, they bought the plans for the Benson gyrocopter out of the back of Popular Mechanics and built it in their backyard and then tried to teach themselves to fly it. And bad things happen, you know.
Sure.
So they kind of got a bad rap early on in their career, which is, I think, why they kind of faded away for a while. They always hung in there in the low level. But in the last 10 years, there have been a resurgence with the European manufacturers that have jumped. It's seems to have been a bigger sport over in the over in Europe, EU, UK, Spain. The three biggest manufacturers are in Italy, Germany, and Spain. And it's always been pretty strong in the UK and Britain. So we're kind of seeing a resurgence. It's kind of growing here in the US. A lot of the European manufacturers are establishing dealer networks here that are promoting the sport, promoting their products and stuff. And they're really very well designed, and they've designed out a lot of the early gotchas that were built into the Benson and stuff that are just unheard of nowadays. So they're much, much safer, higher quality, and I think that's going to drive the sport to new levels of interest.
So last question, I promise. What do you have in store for your gyroplane future?
Well, ultimately, I want to teach people to fly gyroplanes. So I've already got several people on a waiting list that want to learn as soon as we've got a two-place, whether that's, and we're looking at options. We've even spoken with local flight schools about maybe adding a gyroplane, because actually, even if someone wanted to become a helicopter pilot, they can save a ton of money by becoming a gyroplane pilot first, because they're about a third the cost, and it all is rotorcraft time. So then it's trained to proficiency on the helicopter side. So that's one angle we're looking at. And then I'm also working with the gyrotechnic people, because I've become pretty good friends with them through this process. And a two-place has been on the drawing board for a while, and right after Oshkosh, he's promised me we're going to hit it hard and design the first two-place gyrotechnic, and then we'll be able to do transition training for people that are going to one of the single-seaters for the first time and be able to do it safely and get them the feel, because it will match the feel of these very closely despite having, you know, two people on board, because it's going to be essentially the same design.
Sure.
So that'll be the next. As soon as that's ready, I'll be doing a lot of the test flying with that when we get going in the two-place configuration. But I'm anxious to start teaching people to fly, because there are a lot of people that are asking me, "When can you teach me? When can you teach me?" Keep telling them soon, very soon. We'll have something. So.
Oh, that's wonderful. Great. Well, thank you so much for last minute allowing us to come in and pick your brain about gyroplanes.
Well, I'm thrilled that my first podcast appearance is on your podcast.
Oh,
so
wow.
I'll be a regular listener now.
Oh, yes. Awesome.
That's one more.
Six. Now we have six people listening. All right. Well, thanks again. And hope to see you in the tandem gyroplane soon.
You'll be the first one I call, so you can come and go for a ride.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was really an honor and a pleasure to be able to interview Lauren at Oshkosh this year. I hope you enjoyed the interview. I certainly did. We had jets cruising by in the background the entire time, but it kind of added to the charm, I think. One thing I thought was interesting and something that I'm really grateful for is Jim and my dad's willingness to actually go to this interview. At the point just before the interview, it was like a bazillion and a half degrees. We were exhausted. My dad looked like he was going to pass out if I asked him to walk 5 more feet. But you guys were freaking fantastic. And you were like, yep, let's go. And because of that, I got to actually see Lauren, which would be actually for the last time, and get to talk to him about the things that he loved most. So really means a lot to me. So thank you. Thank you, Dad. And thanks, Jim, for giving me that opportunity. I didn't know it would be the last time. I had no idea. Like anything, any tragedy, we never know when it's going to be the last time. And now it means even more than it did then, and it meant a lot then. So.
Yeah, that the hike down there in of itself was an experience too, that, like you mentioned, it was a bazillion degrees. We were all tired already. It was towards the end of our adventure, but end of the day, it was totally worth it.
We had brushed off a couple of the things that we were going to do. We were so, so tired, all of us. But yeah, something told me, I was like, I got to go see Lauren. And he was psyched and I was psyched. We were psyched together. And it was a good time.
And with the level of psyched that you were just oozing from your pores, we couldn't have said no to that. So,
now, since you've met Lauren, now you understand, right? He just kind of inspires
100%. 100%. I mean, even that day, I'm like, this was totally worth it. It was so cool going down there. Just, again, his passion for what he does was infectious. I'm glad that we were able to take that opportunity. As we start to close out the episode, though, I will say it's been a really tough, I think, summer in general for general aviation, with the incidents, crashes, the loss that the community's had, and a number of folks that have unfortunately passed in these incidents. So I think if we leave with any thought, just be safe, be careful. This thing that we all do and love, it can be a dangerous thing sometimes. So make sure you're taking care of yourselves and taking care of each other.
But don't be afraid to have some fun. Lauren would want that, you know.
Yep. Go out and engage in this great pastime that we call aviation, and
share it with others. It's a dangerous place out there, folks. Definitely be safe. We don't know a lot about what happened with either Mr. McSpadden's accident or with Lauren's, but regardless, do your best. Keep safe. Keep studying. Always be vigilant. Take care. And spread the joy.
As we close out, I'll also say thank you to you too, Maddie, for giving me the opportunity to meet Lauren and experience that passion myself too. So, like we said, it was a really busy week. We were really tired, but again, your excitement to go talk to Lauren was very evident, and I'm really glad that we had that opportunity. So,
I'm glad you got to meet him.
Yeah, it was special. Well, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Flying Midwest Podcast. I want to thank everyone for taking the time to listen, and not just listen to a regular episode, but honor a guy that had a hell of a lot of passion for aviation. So,
thanks for listening, everybody.
Flight 536, contact Minneapolis Center 132.35. Good day.
Thanks so much for joining us on the Flying Midwest Podcast. Until next time, podcast service terminated, squawk VFR, frequency change approved. Good day.